Hi, I'm Jim. Hi, everybody. Well, where do I start? Let's start with me. Who am I? First, I don't have a home group, you know? I don't believe in them. What I have is home people. And they're all in this room tonight, you know, except for two. There's a little bit of an emergency, but, you know, I just want to show some gratitude to all the people that have gotten me here, and specifically that would be Eric, Willie, Luis, Victoria, Mel, David K., Mumsy, Andy, Fred R., Kathleen, Tiffany, and John B. You know, I wouldn't be here without all you guys, and, you know, all my new brothers in sponsorship. Yeah, so Willie's my sponsor now. That's a new thing. And he's a brave man, very brave man, so thank you for that. And, you know, I was told, my former sponsor had always told me, like, when you get up at the podium, you should really quickly get to where's your home group, who's your qualifier. So my qualifier is me, because I'm the one with the problem, you know, I'm the one with the effects of this disease that acts out and does crazy things. I can't really blame that at anybody else, as much as I'd like to, you know. And then I was also told, like, you know, when I talk about my higher power, to give it context. So I call my higher power that son of a bitch God, which someone told, and, you know, I have this thing where if I like somebody, it's this weird personality quirk, if I like somebody, I swear at them, and if I don't like somebody, I swear at them. So you can only really tell by a tone of voice difference. So it started off, you know, as I didn't like my higher power, and then it became I did like him, but the name kind of stuck. And then I remember, you know, someone said, well, you gotta give people context, because, you know, you'll be up at the podium saying that, and they'll be like, well, this guy doesn't really have any recovery. So there's my context. That'll come into play later. Also, whoever's timing, I'd like a 7-minute warning at the end, if that's possible. I don't know who that is. Would that be... Oh, wait, I shouldn't have to do it myself, man. I'm speaking. This is hard enough. Like, don't we time these things? Like, I hope so. I appreciate that. So, what it was like, well, you know, I'm an only child. And at first, I didn't think that I was affected by alcoholism, which, looking back on it, is hilarious. But what I had was... you know, a rageaholic mother, and then a very unavailable father. Like, I came to this realization at one point that I really know nothing about my father. I mean, he was around. I just don't know much about him. And you know, he'd gotten cirrhosis of the liver at some point, and I'd had some program, and I'd called him up, and I was like, well, you know, Dad, how do you feel? And he's like, well, I'm angry. You know, and then I was like, yeah, but you know, that's just a surface emotion. You know, how do you feel about having cirrhosis? He's like, I don't understand your question. I was like, you know, feelings. Like, what is going on inside of you right now? Like, hurts, resentment. He's like, you are strange. He's like, you are a strange kid. Like, you know, so that's what it was like growing up. But, you know, and I'd ask, because I did, like, one of my first, like, I don't know, however long in here until I did my fourth step, I was like, why am I here? And I knew, at first I'm like, I don't belong here. And then it turned into, I definitely belong here, but I don't know why. And so my very first sponsor was Eric with a K, right? And he was an amazing sponsor, especially when I was new in program. And I'd asked him, you know, what is alcoholism? And he's like, well, it's not the drinking. And then this comes right out of the big book. And this really hit home to me. It was, we were having trouble with relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. And we couldn't seem to be of any real help to other people. And I was like, that sounds about right. And how it was explained to me is this disease of alcoholism, which we all have, whether we have the allergy or not, is, you know, at some point to somebody transmitted through the, or caught through the bottle and transmitted through the air. And somehow I caught it, and I didn't understand why. But growing up, you know, a little bit more about what it was like, is like, you know, the messages that I got were like, you know, it was weird. Like, so my mom, you know, she didn't really like women, and she didn't really like men. So, like, the message I got is, like, I couldn't really trust either gender, you know what I mean? And, like, you know, so, like, the world wasn't safe. And then I was also taught, like, you know, it's not safe to really feel anything except for anger. So that's where I went, and I got really good at it. Very good at it. It was like an art, you know? And, you know, I struggled a lot with, when I was a kid, like, the whole not fitting in thing. Like, I always felt like I was a little bit left of center. Like, I didn't... like, there was something, like, a little bit wrong with me. Even like, compared to all these great men that I come to this meeting with, I'm still, like, a little bit quirkier than they are, you know? Which is kind of fun. But, you know, I finally... Here, I fit in, and it's really nice. But I remember I struggled a lot with... growing up, like... People's parents just would decide they wouldn't like me, and then it'd be like the end of the world for me. I'd be like, oh my god, this person's parents don't like me, and what's wrong with me? And I didn't have any power to do anything about it, you know, a lot of that. So just all this felt like authority was out to get me, my friends were out to get me, like I couldn't really trust anybody. That's a lot about what it was like. And then, what came out during my, when I was reading my fifth step was this incident that had happened when I was in high school. And so, like, what in my experience, what happens when you are left of center and you're not in a program is you have friends that are, you know, drug addicts, lowlifes, and bums, you know? And that's exactly what I had. And I had these two best friends, one of which was a heroin addict. And they lived in this very picturesque house, you know, in the rich part of town, and like a mom and a dad, and they had like a dog, and everybody, they appeared to be a happy family. Except for, you know, my best friend Mark at the time, you know, he was a heroin addict. And there was, you know, he had gone through like, I don't know, 6 or 7 trips through rehab. It was like this big rinse, recycle, repeat type of thing. And how it had come to a head was, we were just supposed to have a movie night, right? It was supposed to be absolutely normal. And, you know, so, and Mark gets caught shooting up heroin, obviously, him and his brother get in this fight, and then the mother gets involved, and the father gets involved, and then the father leaves, and they're giving Mark the whole, like, don't do drugs speech. And what happened was, is he had burst into the room and, you know, beat the kid in front of us. And then the culmination was when he had doused Mark in gasoline and try to set him on fire. And this was my first step to experience, because I'm sitting there watching this, and where I grew up, you, like, it's never really spring. So what happens in the spring is you have really frozen snow on the ground, and then it rains, and then the rain freezes the snow, right? So the old man, like, after he doused him in gasoline, he was just shaking, he just couldn't get the match lit, and then as soon as he got it lit, it started raining, and then Mark had jumped over the fence, right? But it was just like a lot of, and that was normal to me. Like, I just went home the next day and was like, yeah, you know, that was pretty crazy. Like, you know, I didn't think it had an effect on me, but, you know, I've been carrying that with me for a while. And that's a little bit about what it was like. Fun, I know. So, a little bit about how I got here. And, you know, it doesn't get any less dark, so I apologize in advance. But, I mean, it does eventually. But how I got here is I had made the firm decision, I had a complete and total nervous breakdown, and I made the firm decision that I was going to kill myself, right? And there was nothing, I was very, like, when I make a decision, I'm very serious. And I remember my best friend had called me, and she's like, how's your day going? I'm like, well, I'm going to kill myself on Monday. And, like, all she could think to say was, well, how are you going to do it? And I was like, well, I'm like, you know, the thought of the maid having to clean my brains off the ceiling tickles me, so I'm gonna go with a gun. Like, I was that dark. It was very, like, you know. And she was like, oh, okay, well, you know, I love you. She told her mom, she tattled, and then her mom tattled to my mom. My mom called me up and was like, you're not allowed to kill yourself, because she's an untreated Al-Anon too. And she, like, flew out and babysat me, like, made me see a shrink, right? And then the shrink was like, you know, you might want to try Al-Anon. I was like, why? Nobody drinks. Like, and she's like, yeah, just trust me. And I had this meditation teacher that was in AA, and his wife was in Al-Anon. And like, killing myself sounded like a great idea, like, for, like, years. So I'd gone up to him, and we're sitting there, and I'm like, hey, should I kill myself? Because it still sounded like a great idea. And he was like, he never said no. He's like, well, it'd be a very permanent solution to a very temporary problem. He's like, but have you ever thought about Al-Anon? And I was like, well, why? Nobody drinks. And he's like, oh, just you know, based on hearing, knowing you for a while, you know, I think you might find some wisdom in that program. I was like, okay. So, you know, he's my spiritual guy, my spiritual counselor at that point. So I'm like, I'll give it a shot. And I remember my first Al-Anon meeting. I don't even count it, because not only was I hungover, but I brought a date. and I picked her. So, and I had a resentment because she didn't hook up with me the night before. So we're driving in the car all angry, and I'm looking at her, and I'm like, which, you know, I had a resentment. So I'm sitting there with this resentment, and this other girl stands up, and this was my first gift of the program, is this girl stands up, and she's just whining about her life that's going perfectly, right? Like, she's like, well, my dad loves me, and he's an AA, but I hate him so much, and my mom treats me so well, and she's an Al-Anon, but I hate her so much, and my boyfriend just treats me like a princess, and he's an AA, and I just don't understand what's wrong with me. And I remember thinking, what is her problem? And then I get this voice in my head that's like, you're a little judgy, aren't you, buddy? And I was like, oh, I am. And like, I didn't know what to do with that information. And I'd never realized this before. But that was like my first gift of program. And I was like, I should keep coming back and figure out what to do about this judgment problem. Still haven't figured it out. But there's hope. There's hope. You know, and then early on in program, I of course, picked my first sponsor, who was a chick. And I picked her. And she fired me. I needed a good Wednesday meeting, and someone suggested Josiah's meeting in the garage, right? And I'd met this Canadian, right? I remember the first time I saw him, he had a hockey puck or a hockey stick in one hand, you know, he had a beard, he had a Canadian flag t-shirt, he had snow on his back. I was like, this guy is Canadian. And I was sharing about he's not even paying attention. I was sharing about you know, getting fired, and he comes up to me and he's like, that should never happen to anybody. I'm really sorry that happened to you. And I was like, well, you were number two on the list. Why don't you sponsor me? And he was like, I'd be honored. And then, you know, and then he became my sponsor, and we started working the steps. Now I'd like to talk about what it's like now, because I don't like to spend too much time on the mess. That was very dark, so thank you for bearing with me. Well, at first I can tell you, step one was easy. Like, that was just easy. I was already on my knees, and he's like, yeah, life sucks. And I was like, yes! And that was step one. I mean, there was a little more to it, so we start step two, and remember when I was telling you about how my higher power got his name? So step two started off like that, and I was so bad and unsuccessful at step two that my sponsor at the time had to invent a step for me. It was called step 1.5. Like, he invented a step. I was that bad, and what step 1.5 entails, and he had just picked up a new sponsor who had become my grand sponsor, and we had gotten a very new and effective way of working the steps from him. And what I was told to do was to write down all of the ways in which I try to control situations, people, places, things, and what kind of fruits it bears. And I can tell you, I had like 90 things, and the fruits that they bear is never anything like joy, unconditional love. You know, it's never that. It's always like, you know, stuff that's not good for you, like fear, anger, resentment, you know, and that was eye-opening for me. And so I was like, well, what am I going to do to work step two? Because I really hate this son of a bitch guy. And he's like, what I want you to do is, he's like, first of all, you know, your friend Andy, and you know, my friend Andy's very special to me. He couldn't be here tonight. So yeah, you know, there was an issue, but he's here in spirit. But like, I was told, like, your friend Andy has the best higher power in the world. And if you want to learn what your higher power is like, just hang out with him and watch him, right? So I remember I'd like hang out with him, I'd like be staring at him. I'm like, Andy. He'd be like, what? He'd be like, do something higher power-y. Like, what are you talking about? And everybody always asked me like what kind of things happen to Andy. I'll give you a quick anecdote. I remember for like a year, he's like, he had an issue at work, and like, you know, he lost his job, and for like a year he's like, I can't find another job, and you know, I didn't like working for those people. I don't want to go back to them, and I can't find a job, right? And meanwhile, my sponsor, he's like, my office. He's like, my office is a goddamn death trap, right? And like one time I was like, I haven't heard from you in 2 days. What happened? He was like, I was organizing some papers, and they fell on me. And I was like, why didn't you call for help? Because I was buried under papers, right? So, you know, this is not much of an exaggeration. And so I was like, interesting. I'm listening to both of them. I'm like, well, Andy, I'm sure you'll find a job. And I was like, well, you know, Willie, I'm sure that maybe next time just don't try and jump when the papers start collapsing. And then so like what had happened was is you know, Andy started having a series of health problems, and then Willie was like, wait a second, why don't you just come work for me and organize the death trap? So then Andy all of a sudden had a boss that loved him. He had a job. He had self-esteem. Like, he was even harder working than Willie was. Like, he'd be there at 6 in the morning standing over him like, Dad, wake up. It's time to go to work. Like, you know, and that to me is like a higher power in action, because is like, I remember Andy saying to me like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to let it go. That's all he said. And then like, 3 days later, he was employed. So that was pretty amazing. It's just like hundreds of little things like that. And then another thing I had started doing was a lot of service. Like, when I was very new in program, like, I, you know, became a secretary, and like, you know, everybody just loves to volunteer me for things. So I ended up like a secretary, intergroup, world service. That's why I'm raising money for SCAC and all that. You know, so you know, and it's good. It's service is very important to me. So I would just like to say, like, if you want recovery, you should do service, and if you want patience, you should do service above the group level. Yeah. So, and that was instrumental in my recovery. Another thing that was instrumental was like my great grand sponsor, and my grand sponsor at the time, participated very as much in my recovery as my sponsor, and then I had Luis as my backup sponsor. You know, when they were all pissed off at me, which happens occasionally, you know. And it's just like all those people being there for me, like, really, really helped me get to where I am now. And there's something I'd done with Eric, is he's like, well, you know, you don't seem to have any feelings, like, any words for him. So he's like, so I'm going to give you a word of, like, 60 feelings. I'm like, there's all those feelings? He's like, yeah. And so he's like, I want you to just write down what you feel every day and just call me and tell me about them. And so, like, I learned that I could be feeling, not only was I feeling a lot, but they'd be, like, conflicting emotions. So, like, joy, yet hatred, or, like, despair, yet hopefulness, like, all at the same time. It was pretty insane. And that, you know, that gave me words so I could tell people, like, I can connect with people on that level, except for my dad. But, you know, most people I can be like, you know, I'm just feeling some hurt and disappointment, you know, and stuff like that. And I owe that to Eric. So thank you for that. You know, and then I realized another thing that I learned from my friend Andy is, like, you know, for his disease, he has to take pills every day. And even sometimes when he's taking his pills, like, he still has a seizure, you know, and that really is a metaphor for my program. Is like, I have to work this program. It's life or death. Like, I have to work this program when I'm happy, when I'm sad, when I'm angry. And sometimes, even if I'm like working steps and calling my sponsor and doing all that, I still have a slip, you know, like, I say sarcastic things, I say mean things, you know, all those character defects sometimes rear their ugly head. But, you know, it's a daily practice. And I guess that was good direction I had gotten. And I remember saying to myself, like, I remember having this fear that I was unlovable, like, just unworthy of love. And then I had met Christina and Robert, right? And Robert was, at the time, I was 2 years old. And sometimes kids, they just love you for no reason, right? And they just pick you. And he just decided that he loved me, and I was his new best friend, you know? And that really, you know, it really taught me how to love someone unconditionally. Like, I'll give you an example. Like, the other day, like, he always wants to drive with me after the Saturday meeting when we go out for fellowship. And so we put his car seat in the car, we put him in. And I remember when I was a kid, we were driving to visit my uncle, and I wanted to read a comic book, and it was dark. And I was like, oh, if I open the door, I'll get some light, right? That was my best thinking at 8. And I did, and my dad just yelled at me like, oh, you're stupid, and like, just like, and then for like 10 years I did, remember when you were 8, you dumbass, and you know, just for like years of my life. And so what happened was like, Andy's in the passenger seat, Robert's in the back seat, we're having a good time, and all of a sudden the door opens. And I look at him, I'm like, did you open the door? And he's like, no. And now I got this car, nowadays cars will tell you which door is open. On a big LED screen, right? And I'm like, okay, I'm not saying that you're lying to me, but there's a screen right here, and the screen is showing that the door is open, and, you know, I'm just very upset right now because, you know, you could fall out of the car and get hurt, and that's not something to experiment with. And he was like, all right. And then, you know, it's like, and it's just my reaction to what he did was very loving, you know, and I didn't really have skills like that before, you know? So, I mean, like, he's very important to me, and we're the same age. We're both 3 now. So that's, you know. Do a lot of work. But two, I remember, like, I tried to work step seven early. And that's how this really all started. And we were talking about, like, having God remove your character defects. And I went up to Eric and I was like, I was like broken, destitute, and starving to death. And I just could not get a job. And it may have had something to do with my attitude. I don't want to speculate, but that may have had something to do with it. So I go up to Eric, I'm like, I'm ready for that son of a bitch God to remove my character defect of joblessness, right? This is what I say to him. And he's like, that's not a character defect. And I argue with him, I'm like, you're wrong, and you're Canadian, and you don't understand. And he's like, he just got exasperated, and he's like, fine, we'll talk about it later. So I was like, oh, we will. So I called him. Like when I got my hit it or quit it notice from the landlord, I'm like, hey, I'm like, it's time to work on this character defect of joblessness. And he was really good at sponsoring me. He's like, you know what, I was wrong. That is a character defect, you know? He's like, I was 100% wrong. I'm like, thank you. Was that so hard to admit? And he's like, but that's like a mother character defect. He's like, we can't just attack that. What about the ones that caused that? I was like, all right, tell me about those. He's like, well, what about like dishonesty, arrogance, self-righteousness? I was like, yes, I have all of those things. And he's like, he's like, all right, let's work on honesty. He's like, are you lying on your resume? I'm like, of course I'm lying on my resume. I'm like, are you supposed to get a job if you don't lie on your resume? And he's like, well, you can't lie on your resume. I'm like, that's stupid. He's like, all right. He's like, you know what? I want you to call Willie and see what he thinks about that. I was like, I will, thinking that Willie was going to agree with me, right? Like, that was really what I had. So I call up Willie. I'm like, remember the other day when we were talking about being rigorously honest? Like, what is that in percentage? Is that like 80? 85% honest. He's like, no, it's 100. I'm like, well, what about like 92, 93% honest? He's like, you gotta be. He's like, what is this about? I'm like, I've been lying on my resume. He's like, you can't lie on your resume. I was like, hey man, I'm like, you're old. You're an entrepreneur. You haven't been out there in a while. You don't know what it's like. You have to lie on your resume. Otherwise, people won't give you a job. And he got exasperated. Like, that's like, well, he's got the patience of a sage. So he's like, you know what? He's like, I want you to call your friend John H. He's like, 'cause you would agree that he's a pretty honest guy, right? I'm like, yeah, he's the most honest guy I know. He's like, okay, if John H. gives you explicit permission to lie on your resume, by all means, you can lie on your resume. And I'm thinking, this kid's my friend, so he's gonna roll with me on this. So I'm like, John, I'm coming over. And he's like, all right. So I go over to his house, and I'm like, he's like reading my resume. He's like, King of Egypt, huh? I think at one point I said I was like running a whole country. I was like, goddamn right, I was the king of Egypt. He's like, look, let's not dig around in the dirt. He's like, let's just put this resume aside. He's like, what I want you to do is just write down every job you've had from when your parents gave you an allowance up until now, and we'll just see what happens. And we did. And he's like, oh, you're a project manager. And I'm like, what's that? And we Googled it and we learned what it was, and we geared my resume to that. And so I'd started getting all of these calls for job interviews, but I still wasn't getting the job, right? And I had to really work with you know, both Willie and Eric very hard on this. I guess, you know, I don't want to speculate. It may have been my attitude. I don't know. But so, like, and so everybody and their mother wanted to get me a job at DirecTV, right? And I was making zero money at the time. Like I was pretty much almost living on the street. And finally it got to the point where like someone would call and I would just laugh at them. They're like, "When to get you a job at DirecTV?" I'd be like, "Ha ha ha, you're funny." So these guys call and John's wife had said, you know, don't be rude to these people. She's like, "You're being rude. Pretend like you like the opportunity." And they're like, pretend it's John calling you on the phone and you like him. I was like, fine. So they call and they're like, well, we want to get you a job at DirecTV. And I was like, yeah, okay. And they're like, no, we'll call you back in 15 minutes with an interview. So I'm like, all right. So 15 minutes later, they called. They're like, you got an interview tomorrow. The next day I went in for the interview wearing a suit. I was very overdressed. Like the guy showed up wearing like a paisley shirt and cowboy boots. And he's like, I like your moxie, kid. You start on Monday. And then, you know, I went from like, you know, making nothing to doing fairly well, you know, and that was all thanks to God and step two and working this program and all that. And honesty, like I think honesty was the main driver behind that. Just like, I didn't really lie. Of course, he didn't really ask me much questions in the interview, but it still counts. I would have been honest. So you know, I'd lost that job. I don't want to speculate. It may have had something to do with my attitude. But they liked me, so they're like, yeah, we like your work, we like you, you're just not a fit, so we're gonna give you like a month, we're gonna pay you and just look for another job. So I started doing these interminable like Groundhog Day style interviews where like it was the same company over and over and over again. No matter what you did, you could like light the office on fire, or you can go in, you could bribe them with like $100 that you'd never get a second interview. So finally, I called up William. He's like, "Oh, just go in there, just be honest today, right?" And so like I'd been in a program like maybe like a year and a half, 2 years at this point. And you know, I go strolling into this interview, I sit down, I'm smiling, like I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm feeling joy, I'm feeling some joy today, right? But I didn't realize it, and so the lady wasn't very nice. She's like, "Why are you smiling? Are you nervous or something?" And Willie said, "To be honest, so." And wait, where's Christina? Hold on, I gotta hide. She always gets mad when I tell this story. So like, so she's like, why are you nervous or something? And I thought, he said to be honest, so I'm really trying to give her an honest answer. I'm thinking about like, why am I smiling? I'm like, I'm happy to be alive. I'm like, wait. I haven't felt that since I was 6 years old. I was like, wait a second, I've gotten my will to live back. I'm like, I've had my will to live since I was 6 years old. And I go, you know what? I'm happy to be alive. And of course, I didn't get the job because she thought I was crazy. And then for like a month after, like Chris, every time I have a job interview, Christina's like, don't tell them you're happy to be alive. If they ask, you're miserable. I was like, okay, all right, I will. So I did. Eventually, I'd worked a fourth step, right, which is what separates the men from the boys. So do your fourth step, and the women from the ladies as well. You know, works for all of us. And I was spending, you know, and we got in a method that was very similar to the blueprint, except like more in depth. So it was like based off the blueprint. And I was spending like 4 to 6 hours a night on it. I was a terrible person to be around. And some people were like, "Call Eric, you're terrible to be around." I was like, "Oh, I am." So I called him. I'm like, "Hey," he's like, how long are you spending on your four step every night? I'm like, you know, 4 to 6 hours a day. And he's like, "Whoa!" Like, apparently that's not normal. This is how I do things. Like, I work a solid program. He's like, "You need to pace yourself." And that was like a major argument we got. And I'm like, "That's the stupidest thing. Why would I pace myself?" He's like, fine. He's like, "Spend 4 to 6 hours a day. See how it works out for you." He's like, "I will." Like, you know, we got in a big argument over that. We didn't really argue that much. That we did argue over. And, you know, and I remember, like, as it was getting bigger, I'd tell Willie, like, I'd be like, "Willie, it's up to 200 pages now." And he'd, like, laugh a little. And then eventually it gets up to 1,008 pages. Right? And I'm still sick. Like, after writing 1,008 pages, still like, Willie just thinks this is the most hilarious. He's like, "Ah!" He's like, "See? It's like being a grandfather, you know, being your great-grandfather." He's like, "I get all the good parts of you, you know? I don't have to listen to your four-step." He's like, "Ah!" He's like, "Eric, ah! Yeah!" He's laughing. He's like he sees Eric, he's like, "You?" He's like, "You're in for a lot of work, son." He's like, "I hope you got one of them hemorrhoid pillows." Like, and so I had beaten Eric on my steps, you know, which, you know, and he'd shared about, like, that inspired him to, like, finish his fourth step, you know, that made me feel really good. And, you know, he had told me that before he shared about it. You know, it was really nice because, like, he would always inspire me just as a human being and a sponsor, and Willie, too. Both of them. But, you know, it's like for him to say, like, you know, you really work a solid program and you've even, like, now even I look up to you, like, was just very humbling for me, you know, and very touching. And but I was horrible to be around after doing this four step, you know. Wait, what? No, nothing. All right. Horrible to be around after doing this four step. And, so Eric's like, "Yeah, you know, you can't just, I can't hear it because I haven't done my fifth step." He's like, "You're going to have to read it to Willie." So I call up Willie. I'm like, "Yeah, Eric says I got to read you my four step." He's like, "I'll get my hemorrhoid pillow and start reading it." So we spent all summer, like every Monday reading this four step, and by the end of the summer, he's like, "What page were you?" I'm like, 130. He's like, "Oh, God." I said, "God damn it." He's like, "You're gonna be reading this four step to me on my deathbed." He's like, "I'm 75 years old. So this will be the last thing I hear before I die." So we started doing it every Monday, Wednesday, and Sunday for 8 months. 8 months. And that really meant a lot to me. You know, he really showed up for me. And sometimes, like, you know, he was a trooper, too. Like, sometimes he'd work a full day, and it'd be, like, 11 at night. He'd be like, "All right, we got to get through this thing. Just read me something." He'd fall asleep, and I'd sit there patiently. He'd take a cat nap. He'd wake up, be like, "What did I miss?" I'd be like, "Nothing. I waited for you." He'd be like, "Oh, why didn't you just keep reading?" It's like, it's all a pattern anyways. You know. And it just, you know, and we got through it, and I didn't, it's interesting because I didn't, like, I remember long-haired Bruce had told me, like, he said, when I did my fifth step, man, he's like, I saw the clouds open up, and, like, God fell from the heavens, and was like, it was like that Beavis and Butthead Do America scene, where there was, like, little, like, Rat Fink guys playing the guitar. I was like, that sounds awesome. That didn't happen for me. Like, it was just a gradual getting better, and what we were left with was, you know, obviously a list of character defects, a list of resentments, and a list of possible amends I may have to make. And that's interesting. What the interesting thing about the steps is they're not linear when you get past the fifth step. Like, it all becomes some sort of giant circle that flows one into the next, at least in my experience. I could be wrong. Because I have stories about, I'm on six technically, but I have stories about working 6, 7, 8, and 9, which we're about to get to. You know, and I, you know, it's at some point, like, I really wanted to get through these steps, and, you know, I made the decision to change sponsors. And it's not that Eric did anything wrong. I mean, he was an incredible sponsor, and he's still a big part of my life, you know. But I asked Willie to be my sponsor, and he accepted. And I'm afraid that I'm going to kill him, because, see, like, Eric was like this. Like, he's like, I don't have a horse in the race, right? So, like, I'd call him up and be like, I just murdered 7 people. And he'd be like, okay. He's like, don't panic. He's like, I'll come over with a shovel. We'll hide bodies. Like, don't even freak. We'll talk about maybe why you did this. Like, whereas, like, Willie is on the roller coaster with me. Like, I'm Willie. I met a girl at work. Oh, that's great. Oh, what's her name? Is she hot? Yeah. Her name's Yvette. Oh, man, I'm so happy for you. He's like, oh, this is gonna be awesome. And then, like, Willie, I went on a date with Yvette, and she was just an awful person. I think she might be an alcoholic, and I was, and I'm never talking to her again. He's like, oh, I'm depressed. He's like. He's like, this is so sad. He's like, I need a moment. He's like, let me call you back in 5 minutes. I'm like, all right, but don't go near the pile of papers. You know, so it's been a different experience. But so what someone pointed out to me is, like, I still need Eric, and I still need Willie, and I still need Luis and all these other people. And so, like, Eric the other day was like, you know, he's like, you know, when you had that conversation with me that you wanted to change, he's like, I just was laughing at you, because he's like, we're already sharing you anyways, like, splitting the duties. He's like, what you do is you follow that second tradition. You set up, like, your own little group conscience that you trust for yourself. And he's like, and I think that's good, because, you know, he's like, someone like you, it takes a village, so. You know. But, you know, and some amazing things started to happen, you know, in these weird mid-range steps that go in a circle or whatever. Like, for instance, I'd gotten this job in Compton, which is a big trucking hub, and I'd gotten hit by a truck, right? Like a semi-truck. And so, let me backtrack. I finally bought myself, like, a brand new car, and I had resentment because, you know, I'd gotten ripped off on it. So I'm driving around with this new car with a resentment. I just hated the thing. Absolutely hated it. Everyone's like, oh, this car is so great. Hated it. So I'm with a coworker. We're sitting. We're at a right turn lane. I just realized there's not going to be enough room for us in the truck. So I do the right thing. You know, the anti-road rage thing. I pull over. I let the truck go. He slams into us, pulls the bumper off, and did enough damage to where we weren't hurt. But, like, the car was pretty much damaged beyond repair. And then the guy just kept driving, you know, big semi-truck. And that was a God experience right there, because, you know, like, nobody was injured. And, you know, I'd gotten a tow back to Burbank, and, you know, I'd driven it up to, you know, I had him throw the bumper in the trunk. And I went, you know, the insurance company, like, well, it's under your deductible, yet the car's wrecked, so have fun. I was like, all right, thank you. So I drove up to a car dealer, and I'm like, well, what can you do for me? They're like, all right, we'll buy you out of your loan. And so what ended up happening is I got my own car. See, it looks exactly the same, a year newer, the same amount of money I was paying for those car payments with a maintenance package. And I don't have a car loan. And to me, that was like a big, giant God shot. And this all happened in like 2 days, because it's like, I was taken care of. And what was interesting about that experience is, like, the old me, I would have been sarcastic and swearing at people. And, like, especially when the tow truck driver was like, we're going to Burbank. And he decided to give us the circular tour of Los Angeles. Like, we were in Malibu at one point. I'm like, why are we at the end of the trip? He's like, oh, we're going to Burbank. And I resisted the urge to be like, yeah. What's the matter with you? I was just like, oh, yeah, I thought you knew. Thank you for the ride. I appreciate it. You know, and it's weird because I don't know who this person is. Like, you know, this isn't what I was like. You know, the old me would have been like, you know what the old me would have been like. I don't have to tell you. But, you know, so, like, things like that happen. And then I had made an amends to like an old roommate I had his glasses, and I just like would get depressed and like not call people back, and he was just really upset that I didn't return his glasses, right? And I'm carrying this guilt with me, and I tell Willie, I'm like, I gotta make an amends to this guy. I was telling him about the glasses. He's like, all right, just go in there, just give him his glasses back, be like, you know, I'm sorry, you know, sometimes I get depressed, I fall into a hole, I was being selfish, yada yada yada, right? So he meets me for dinner, he's happy to see me, he's sitting across from me, and I hand him his glasses. I'm going through my whole amends, like, you know, I was selfish, I was wrong. And he's nodding, he's looking at the glasses, looking at me, he goes, I had LASIK. He's like, but thank you. This means a lot to me. He's like, these are gonna make a good paperweight or something like that. I don't know, but like, it's just interesting. And then, it's just funny. And then, you know, like, and some amends didn't go so well. Like, you know, I'd done some, you know, there was a girl before program that I was very much in love with, you know, and the disease had gotten in the way, right? And, you know, and at its worst, like, you know, she had, like, some sort of relationship she didn't want to be in, and she'd invited me on a romantic trip to India, and I was going to do it. And then Eric had talked me out of it because he's like, it's not esteemable. She just has to, like, be a woman and break up with her boyfriend if she wants to be with you. And I told her that, but in nicer words, and, like, you know, and our whole relationship had changed, and it's like what happened is she saw the recovery in me, and it scared her, and it kind of scared me too, because I'm like, wow, I'm not yelling at her. It's like, wow, I haven't really called her any names. Like, that's not as fun as it used to be, but you know, I definitely feel a lot better. You know, well, that was an exaggeration. It was never fun, but acting like that, you know, it's just, she just couldn't get it together. It's like, you know, they say, we hear about those people that have, you know, our disease and that allergy to alcohol so bad to where, like, even the 12 steps can't save them. It's like, she may be one of those people, you know. We had a long conversation, like, I'm in Al-Anon, this is what I do, like, you should do this. And, like, she just didn't, no desire to get any better. And so I'd done some writing, and I had read the writing, and I was told I needed to make an amends for something, and that amends was I was supposed to offer her my friendship, right? So we had done this whole dance, and how it ended was that she, and you know, like, this program is life or death to me, right? And she had said, like, oh, I'd love to see you, and yeah, you know, you can come and make this amends. And she said, oh, no, you can't, and you're causing tension in my life. And it was almost as if she tried to kill me, you know, with that, like, and that's how I felt. So we had to kill her off, metaphorically speaking. We had a funeral, and I took, you know, and like, yeah, Willie did not condone the funeral, but we had it at his house. What we did is we took all the trinkets. I wrote an obituary. We read the obituary. I read a goodbye letter. You know, I did a lot of work with, like, I don't know if Juan's here tonight, but Juan sat with me for like just hours. You know, like, at one point, like, helping me write this goodbye letter, you know, and that, you know, that really meant a lot to me. Like, there's a lot of men in this program that have been there for me, and, you know, I have a lot of gratitude about that, you know. And so, you know, we ended up burning everything because she was Buddhist. You got to respect other people's beliefs, and that was the best I had in me, because I just learned that I just don't have the recovery to have this person in my life, you know, and that's on me. But I needed the freedom around it, you know, because I was just walking around with this fantasy that we were going to, like, take that romantic trip to India she invited me on, and, you know, ride naked on elephant back as young lovers and ride into the sunset, and, like, you know, it just wasn't going to happen. And I feel like it was holding me back, you know, I was like, seriously. And, you know, so that was, but I remember, you know, Willie had said to me, he's like, you know, you can't, we're gonna have to figure something out, because you can't just kill off the women you love just because they don't want to do what you want to do. And he was absolutely right, you know. But, you know, so that was an experience for me, you know, but I got that freedom that I needed, and that was huge, because I didn't have that. But I'm going to tell you guys how I learned acceptance. And this is a good story. So back to little Robert, right? And so we have this thing we do where, like, he'll sit on my shoulders. And how that works is, like, I face this way. He also faces this way. I pick him up. I lift him over my head and onto my shoulders, right? So one day, you know, I'm over at his house. We had like a few people from the program over and we're just having a good time and we're outside and I see something over the fence and I say, "Do you see that?" And of course he doesn't see it because he's about yay tall, right? So I'm like, "All right, well here, let me lift you up." So I get to about here and the kid just pisses all over me. Like it's in my hair, like it's in my clothes, like just like, and it's my fault. Because let me backtrack in the story. Like a few months before that, I'd asked his mother, I said, you know, what do I do if he tells me he has to go to the bathroom? And I'm learning all these fatherhood skills and program for all you single ladies out there. And she's like, it's the easiest thing in the world. You just stand him in front of the toilet, you pull his pants down, you pull his diaper down, you let it rip, you pull everything back up. I'm like, okay, easy enough. So me and this guy, Stacy, who some of you might remember, you know, we were babysitting him at the Little White Chapel, and he tells me that he has to pee, right? So I'm like, okay, buddy. So I stand him in front of the toilet, you know, I pull his pants down, I pull his diaper down, and this kid, man, he kicks off his pants and he kicks off his diaper. Like, and I'm like, oh no, this is gonna be an epic piss. Like, I'm like, this is gonna be the greatest piss that anybody, like, he put his hand on the wall, like, he put his hand on the wall, and he's like, "Jimmy, give me a cigarette." I gave him a cigarette, like, he's smoking. He smoked, and then all he did was run around the room, pantsless, with us trading, like, "Put your pants back." I know we looked like a bunch of pedophiles. I had a resentment. I had a big resentment. So now here was the one I was expecting a few weeks later, all over me. And I'm holding this kid, and it, like, he just maybe like this big. I don't know, it was like almost like someone had poured out a gallon jug of water. And so, you know, I run to his mom. I'm like, "He just pissed all over me in the yard and himself." And she's like, "Oh, you can handle it." So I had to accept that. I'm like, "All right, I'll handle this." So like normally, like when I carry him, I would hug him, you know, tenderly, I'd stroke his head. But I'm carrying him like this because he is like soaked in urine. And I just didn't feel, I wasn't in a very huggy mood, right? And he's freaking out, I'm freaking out. We get him into the bathroom, I go to flip on the switch, and she had this landlord that wouldn't fix things. There's no light. I had to accept that. So I'm like, "All right, we're gonna bathe in the dark." I got the tub going, he's splashing, he's happy. So I'm like, "All right, buddy, where's the soap?" And he points, and I look, and he's right, it was soap, but it's not the kind of soap that you clean two-year-olds with, it's the kind of soap you clean toilets with. So I'm like, "That's not the right kind of soap." And he's like, "It's up there," and we're fighting. So finally I say to the kid, "You know what? You might be right." And he was happy. And so, you know, so we found some soap, we're bathing them, like the waters. Then I couldn't figure out how to turn the water off, you know? And I wasn't, like, you know, I wasn't gonna jump into the tub and save the kid because I'm a nice guy, but I'm already shirtless and soaked in urine. I'm not that nice of a guy. So I'm like, "All right, the kid's gonna drown." I accepted that, right? And so, you know, the water's filling up, it's filling up and filling up, and I'm bathing. I'm like, "Man, we have got to figure out how to turn this water." And so, like, eventually his mother runs in. She, like, turns the water off. She's like, "Oh, you just do this." I don't know how she did it. She's like, she turns the water off, right? We get the kid toweled off. She gave me a shirt, and that's how I learned acceptance. Thank you. So, this was the end of my outline. Now I got a filibuster. All right, so I have a great story for you. I have a great story for you. So like, I'm a very willful person. It's one of my major character defects. And, like, that's why I have to do, like, you know, what I'm directed by my sponsor. It's like, otherwise, you know, how do I know if it's my will? So I remember, like, one time I didn't want to take this job because it was in Manhattan Beach and I didn't want to drive. And he's like, "Well, it sounds like we're talking about your will." And I'm like, "Well, tell me what to do." He's like, "I can't, because then it'll be my will." And I was like, "All right, well, how do we figure out what God's will is?" He's like, "I'm glad you asked." So he pulls out a quarter. And he's like, "We flip a coin once." And he's like, "And heads, you know, you take the job, tails, you don't, and that's God's will." So we flipped the coin, it was heads that took the job. That was God's will, and then I, you know, made a commitment to do it, and then I had gotten another job. Someone just called and was like, "Hey, do you want a job?" I was like, "Yes." You know, all from going, you know, getting out of that whole self-will thing. So, you know, that's one thing that's been a struggle for me. And, I don't know. I think that's all I got. We got about 5 minutes left. I don't know. I think I'm going to end there.